thank you all for coming out to join this discussion. I'm glad we had a little bit of interval between John Stewart and me, because I was going to have a tough time following that with my own talk. But now that you've had a little bit of time, I shouldn't keep mentioning it. So what I want to start by talking about is my little run-in with the National Football League. And this here is my weblog, or some archived post from my weblog. And as I was watching the Super Bowl, I was watching it as only a copyright law professor can, looking out for both Prince's halftime show, which featured the guitar shaped in the shape of the Prince symbol over which there had been a derivative works lawsuit that we had just finished reading in copyright class. And then shortly after I finished clipping that out, there came on the announcer in the third quarter who intones this.
This telecast is copyrighted by the NFL. For the private use of our audience, any other use of this telecast or any pictures, descriptions, or accounts of the game without the NFL's consent is prohibited.
Back here at Dolphin Stadium, Jim Nance with Phil Simms. Seems like it's been forever since we saw that Chicago offense. The last 24 offensive plays run in this game, 23 of them by the Colts. And on real time...
Just letting you see the whole clip so that you can see this. This is the entirety of what we're talking about. So I saw that. I heard it during the Super Bowl. And to a copyright law professor, those are the highlights. And so I posted it to YouTube as Super Bowl highlights. And I'm not going to play it again, but... and captioned the NFL's overreaching copyright claims, given a few tags that will attract both Super Bowl viewers and fans of fair use and legalese. And I posted that to share on my weblog, to share with students in class, and posted that on February 8th. Well, 5 days later, got a notification from YouTube. This is to notify you that we have removed or disabled access to the following material as a result of a third-party notification by National Football League claiming that this material is infringing. Well, I suppose I should have expected that, given that their copyright warning claimed that any other pictures, accounts, or descriptions of the game violate NFL's rights. Surely they wouldn't want their copyright warning posted either. I was a little surprised at how quickly it happened. So I quickly went over to the Chilling Effects Clearinghouse, where we have a counter-notification generator form. because these notifications are spelled out in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The DMCA Section 512 sets up a safe harbor for internet service providers, that they can clear themselves of the risk of infringement liability for user-posted content if they have a copyright policy, if they register an agent for notification with the Copyright Office, and if they respond expeditiously to notices of claimed infringement. All of that's set out in Section 512, and specifically in Section 512C, that tells copyright holders what it is that they need to include in one of those notifications to file. They must identify the material that they claim infringes, with a sufficient identification to permit the service provider to locate it. They have to allege that they own a copyright and have a good faith belief that the use of the material is not authorized by the copyright owner, its agent, or the law. And finally, they have to state under penalty of perjury that the complainant has the right to act on behalf of the copyright holder. So YouTube received from the NFL a notification that set out 162 different URLs of YouTube postings that the NFL claimed infringed its rights. Here it is. This is what YouTube gets. It's a little bit hard to believe that a person really read all or any of these clips, or viewed any of all of these clips. It's entirely possible that a robot went out sweeping YouTube for anything that mentioned Super Bowl and maybe glanced at the shot that YouTube shows as its sort of static image. And sent this notice to YouTube alleging all of the statements that the DMCA requires. So
be clear, Wendy, they didn't send that to you. You had to get that.
They sent this to YouTube. YouTube forwarded me on just a little notification, and when I responded, I asked them to send me this. So they hereby certify under penalty of perjury that the information in this notice is accurate, and I am authorized to act on behalf of the NFL. I have a good faith belief that none of the materials or activities listed above have been authorized by the NFL, its agents, or the law. Well, I didn't share that belief. Rather, I thought that this was clear, fair use of even if this is copyrighted material, and I'll grant that the NFL has a thin copyright in its telecast. They are directing, or someone at their direction is directing cameras, which angles to use and how to splice between shots. And the announcers are speaking original expression as they describe the plays. So while the game itself isn't copyrighted or copyrightable, the telecast has a thin copyright. But there are lots of things that thin copyright doesn't protect. It wouldn't prevent me from coming out of the game with an account of the game or sharing chips with a friend as we described one of the great plays, and it wouldn't even prevent us from taking a few pictures from that telecast, because the copyright law explicitly says that fair use of copyrighted material is not an infringement of copyright, and in the four-factor test for that courts typically use for fair use analysis, the purpose and character of the use. This is not this is a non-commercial educational use used for commentary and criticism of the NFL's overreaching copyright warning, not for for the same purpose or audience as would license a clip from NFL. The nature of the copyrighted work is something, as I said, that's thinly copyrighted. The amount and substantiality of the portion used, the third fair use factor, this is a 30-second clip containing 10 seconds of copyright warning and 20 seconds of football there. To give it context.
You didn't even give the kick return.
I didn't even, nothing happened. Exactly. Someone watching it might have been waiting there in suspense to see what happened and want to go pay the NFL for a licensed clip to see the end of that play, the kick return. But this was merely a tiny snippet of an hours-long game to show what the copyright warning is talking about. After all, somebody who had never seen Super Bowl might be curious about what this copyright warning applied to. And I thought it was reasonable to include that little snippet of gameplay afterwards. The fourth factor in the fair use analysis, often seen as the most important, the effect on the market for the copyrighted work, or the value of the copyrighted work, is zero, zilch. I think there is absolutely no one who was planning to buy any right from NFL who wouldn't by that because of this clip being displayed. I haven't cut into their primary revenue source, the people who buy advertising during the game. I haven't cut into the willingness of networks to bid huge amounts of money to show the game. I haven't cut into the willingness even of their subsidiary licensing markets. So they may well license clips to ESPN or to cell phone providers to show little clips on the cell phone. If they're doing that, they're surely showing highlights and not kickoffs without the returns. So I think there's no plausible effect on the market. And so I still think that there is a strong case to be made for fair use. And so I went over to the chilling effects counter notice generator because, as well as providing for the for a copyright holder to send notification to the internet service provider, the DMCA also says that a user whose material who believes his or her material has been removed as a result of mistake or misidentification of the material can file a counter notification. And the service provider is first faced with the incentive to remove material if it gets this notification, because by removing material, it stays within the safe harbor and can't be sued for copyright infringement. If anyone is sued, it's supposed to be the end user who made the infringing post. But the counter notification provision in 512G says that if the user counter notifies following specific language set forth in the statute, then the service provider can replace the material within 10 to 14 business days and remain free of liability for copyright infringement. So while YouTube might have strong incentives to remove all of the clips, all of the 162 URLs identified in that notice, without examining them to determine whether they are fair use or infringement of copyright, because YouTube deals with huge volume and wants to stay out of lawsuits rather than litigating each user's close case, at least the DMCA gives me an opportunity to ask YouTube, please replace this material, and I'll take the heat if the NFL complains further. So because the statutory language is relatively complex, and we wanted, over at Chilling Effects, wanted to help people understand what they had to say to meet all of the terms of this 512G3, Chilling Effects provides a web form where you can certify your understanding of all of these terms. I will attach a list of works that have been removed or to which access has been disabled. I will include the location of each work before it was removed or access to it was disabled. Each of these works were removed in error, and I believe my posting of them does not infringe anyone else's rights. Fair use is a legal authorization to use copyrighted material even without a copyright holder's express permission, sometimes even against a copyright holder's permission. So I believe that my posting does not infringe anyone's rights. I understand that I'm declaring the above under penalty of perjury. I live in the United States because the statute has some provisions about agreeing to jurisdiction of a United States court that sometimes deters some non-U.S. posters from filing counter notifications. So I consent to the jurisdiction of the district court in whose district I reside, and I consent to be served by the person who gave notice to my service provider or his agent. Wait, that's still lots of legalese in there.
Because I live in the United States, people from outside the United States are not allowed to avail themselves of DMCA?
People outside the United States can use the DMCA as long as they're willing to agree to U.S. jurisdiction.
For that matter. So if you on that thing don't click that?
So this form is not in a position to provide legal advice or to go through all of the questions and answers about how this applies to people outside the United States. And so this form will not complete if you don't check the box, but you can you can file a counter notification as long as you understand and are willing to come to the United States to be sued if somebody wants to sue you for that posting.
U.S. So maybe if you write there, I live in the United, or agree to submit to your U.S. jurisdiction, then I would make a mark on it.
Okay.
Now it would prohibit me to use it.
So we could, that's a good suggestion, that we could expand the form. The language but required is a little bit different for each of the provisions. As a U.S. resident, I have to consent to the jurisdiction of the district court where I live. As a foreign signatory, I think you have just agreed to jurisdiction of a court where the service provider is located. But it's a good suggestion for chilling effects to make this broader and to enable more people to avail themselves of rights. And then fill in the rest of this form, click Generate Counter Notice, and our handy-dandy little PDF generator here gives you a PDF to which you can attach the notice listing URLs and sign it and send it in to the copyright agent. This now contains all of the elements required to trigger the putback provision of the DMCA, and YouTube is told that it can replace the material after 10 to 14 business days and still remain free of liability. Some people think that that's a precisely parallel provision to the takedown because YouTube has to put back or it faces potential liability to me, the poster, for not putting back. In reality, I don't think that balance is there because YouTube's terms of service have already immunized it from any liability to me or to any of its posters. And that's virtually universal across internet service providers and web content hosts, that their terms of service will say something like, we reserve the right to terminate your account or remove material at any time for any reason or no reason at all. So I wouldn't have been able to sue them for not putting the material back up. But YouTube followed through with its step in the DMCA dance, and 14 business days on the nose after I sent in that counter notification, the Super Bowl highlights were back online, and a few people managed to visit them over at YouTube before technical problems made a hash of it. And YouTube notified me that they had, in accordance with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, we've completed processing your counter notification, the content has been restored, and your account will not be penalized. So I wrote up a little summary of what had happened so far, thinking I've got a great little example for my copyright class. I've been criticizing the DMCA in other places for not making sufficient allowance for fair use and free expression. But here, at least, it seemed to have worked. YouTube complied with the putback, and after the 14-day window, the content was back online. So I wrote a little bit about Viacom versus YouTube, and then on St. Patrick's Day, I got another notification from the from YouTube claiming that once again the NFL had claimed my clip infringed, and once again YouTube was removing it. Now, you can scour DMCA 512 for a long time without finding any mention of a second notification and takedown dance. The The strong suggestion in the statute is that there's supposed to be one notice and takedown, a possible putback, and if the copyright holder wants to do anything further about it, they can file a lawsuit. Well, I haven't gotten a complaint, and yet here I was getting another takedown notice. Now, this one, instead of having 162 different URLs, had just one URL. So this time it was clear that a person had seen the video and knew to what they were applying it. And it was also clear to me that they were potentially falling afoul of Section 512F of the DMCA, because at this point, Section 512F says that any person who knowingly materially misrepresents that material or activity is infringing is liable for damages, including costs and attorney's fees, to someone who is harmed by their misrepresentation. So this is the little bit of stick that exists in the DMCA to keep copyright holders honest and copyright claimants honest. If they make knowing material misrepresentations about the ownership of copyright or about the scope of their rights, someone who's harmed by that, either the internet service provider or the poster of the content, can file a lawsuit and get their costs and attorney's fees. So after I had told you the NFL through YouTube, because I send my counter notification to YouTube, and YouTube is instructed by the DMCA to send that on to the copyright claimant. So the NFL had clear notice that I was saying that this was an educational clip containing their copyright warning, and they could or go see the video. They should already have gone to see the video to see that there was no substantial claim of copyright infringement there. At least at the time they sent the second notice, if not at the time they sent the first, they were knowingly materially misrepresenting. The problem with this language is that it is fairly easy for a copyright holder to claim, I didn't know it was non-infringing, I had a good faith belief that it was infringing. And there's lots of potential wiggle room there. As an aside, I like this provision, 512F, very much, because while I was at Electronic Frontier Foundation, we litigated on behalf of some students, Swarthmore students, Nelson Pavlovsky and Luke Smith, who had posted Diebold's email archives online discussing flaws in the Diebold electronic voting machines. And Diebold had sent takedown notices to Swarthmore College demanding their removal. We sued there under 512F, saying this was a clear, fair use, and no copyright holder could have believed that this was an infringement of copyright, and won a nice victory for the eventual reposting of those internal emails. So I had a had and still have a potential 512F claim here that the National Football League is knowingly, materially misrepresenting each time it sends to YouTube a claim that NFL's copyrights are infringed by the above material. So I sent back another, I sent back the same counter notification to them explaining that, you know, this is the same material about which I already counter-notified. Had a bit of fun talking to folks at the Wall Street Journal's law blog and somebody at the New Jersey Star, Newark Star Ledger. And apparently it was the Newark Star Ledger that caught the eye of somebody at the National Football League. And they sent me this letter explaining that it appears from the article that you may not clearly understand our objection to your YouTube posting.
actually.
Yes, please educate me. The clips you posted included game content as well as our copyright notice, and we objected to your posting of the game content, which, as the notice states, is copyrighted. We do not see how the use of such game content has any educational purpose or character. That being said, and here's their generous offer, to the extent that you wish to post only our copyright notice, you have our permission and we would encourage you to do so. So this looks even nicer on paper because it comes with the red and blue NFL logo embossed on top. But still, they're trying to hedge their bets here. They're trying, first off, to tell me you don't really have a 512F claim because we're allowing you to post most of what you wanted to post, but we still object to any posting of our game content. And in the follow-up story that the New York Star-Ledger wrote about this, they said, again, we believe our copyright is a right to control any use of the game content. And so I wrote back to them saying, thank you, I don't think you understand what it was that I was saying, which is that I believe that all of this, the clip in its entirety, is a fair use. That 20 seconds of football is a part of the discussion here, and not enough or substantial enough to raise any copyright infringement claims. And their latest response was an email that there is a substantial difference of opinion between us on this matter that cannot be reconciled, and they cannot agree that 20 seconds of action, of the game action footage was context necessary to make the points I raised. And in response to my request for assurances that they would not send further notifications to YouTube over this same clip, they say I can provide no assurances other than as applied to the copyright notice portion of the broadcast footage you posted. So at this very moment, as you saw, the clip is still online in its entirety, but I've get the NFL telling me there's no assurance it will stay there.
Isn't some of this a moot point because they didn't respond to your original counter notification? Do they then forego the right to issue any more counter notifications, or is this a possible overture for an official complaint from them? I mean, how do you see it? How do they see their options right now, and how do you see their options right now?
Well, there is no waiver in copyright, or generally no waiver of copyright claims based on a failure to file suit at the earliest possible moment. I've still got 3 years from the time I posted it that the copyright statute of limitations, when they could sue for infringement, and I've still got 3 years from the time of their initial knowing material misrepresentation to file a 512F claim that they have misused the copyright takedown provision. I think they are probably reacting to a story that they see has grown a little bit bigger than they expected when the Wall Street Journal starts featuring this and other newspapers, USA Today had a column that discussed it. They start to, I imagine, feel a little bit silly about all of this and try to make themselves seem reasonable with these offers of meeting me halfway. I don't think it's particularly reasonable for them to claim that a 20-second clip of football in which nothing happens is an infringement of copyright, and I will continue to argue that. We're in suspense. I'm waiting to see what happens next see where my education in the uses and misuses of Safe Harbor go next. Direct questions. I'm going to get to questions. in a moment. I just want to sort of wrap up with a sort of tie into the bigger Viacom versus YouTube story, and because in the middle of...
Your story is bigger than yours, Wendy.
Well, within this room, I appreciate that, but out there, there are people watching Viacom versus YouTube, too, and there... my story illustrates some of the flaws and problems in the DMCA, and a point that I've been raising over at Chilling Effects and in things that I've been writing for a while, that it can tend to silence the speaker, the person who wants to post unpopular content or the person who wants to criticize a copyright holder using little clips from... of copyrighted material, or the person who wants to criticize a competitor and the competitor is unscrupulous and uses DMCA takedowns as a way to get that removed from the net or from search engines, all of those people are potential victims of this DMCA process, especially if they don't know all of the legal ins and outs of filing counter notifications. In the time running Chilling Effects, now going on 5 years, we've seen only a handful of counter notifications, even though we've seen hundreds of DMCA takedown notices. Very few people are confident enough in their rights to make this declaration, even though we've counted up hundreds among those DMCA notifications that are erroneous and target non-infringing material, or at least dozens that target non-infringing material, hundreds that have other errors in their form. And so for these individuals and for the public who depends on being able to receive that speech, the DMCA has problems, but the DMCA also has promises. And that's where the Viacom lawsuit comes in, because YouTube is a service that is built on the backbone of this DMCA safe harbor. The safe harbor, Section 512C, says to content hosts, you can accept postings from users. You don't need to screen those users' postings. You don't need to impose filters before the content goes up. You don't need to undertake the near impossible task of tracking down potential copyright claimants for each piece of material that's posted. All you need to do is respond to notifications of claimed infringement when you get them. And have a copyright policy and an agent registered with the Copyright Office so that the copyright claimant can find you. And is that a question? So YouTube has registered its copyright agent and has a policy that includes the termination in appropriate circumstances of repeat infringers. And it responds expeditiously to notices of claimed infringement, as it did here when NFL notified, and as it did in the numerous batches of times that Viacom has filed notifications asking for takedown of clips of The Daily Show or Colbert Report. And so the complaint that Viacom has leveled against YouTube, complaint for copyright infringement, direct infringement, for contributory infringement, for vicarious infringement, for inducement of copyright infringement, the newest secondary liability claim introduced by the Supreme Court in the MGM versus Grokster litigation. They've heaped all of these upon YouTube, but they've never once alleged that YouTube failed to follow the notification and takedown process. They never alleged that they couldn't get in touch with YouTube, or that they sent YouTube a notification to which YouTube didn't respond. Their complaint is instead based on the "it's too hard" theory. It's too hard, too much of a burden on us to send YouTube all of these notifications. We would prefer to shift the burden of protecting our property to YouTube. Even though we are in the best circumstances to be able to identify our copyrighted content, we'd rather make anyone who wants to allow users to upload video re-implement filters and moderation mechanisms in order to find that stuff before it gets online. And that burden might, at the end of the day, be something that an entity on the size of YouTube, now owned by Google, could bear. It still wouldn't be perfect. The filters, even all of the combined audio-visual filters that are that we constantly hear are in development, aren't going to be able to identify all of the material that is posted without authorization. They're never going to be able to identify on an automated basis whether material is posted with authorization or without, because after all, it's not an infringement of copyright to post material with the authorization of the copyright holder, or if you are the copyright holder. But filtering might be able to get to an approximation, but it's going to be expensive. It's expensive to hire staff to review all of the notices that a filter kicks up, or to review all of the content before users are permitted to post it. So even if YouTube could do that, the next YouTube likely couldn't get started in that environment. And I like to remember that YouTube itself started out as an independent two guys dreaming up what could the web do for us next, and quickly surpassed sort of the product that Google, the behemoth, was trying to build, Google Video. It's still up there. Nobody uses it. Everyone uses YouTube. But somebody else out there could be building the next great thing that will be even better than YouTube, and we'll all flock over there. Instead, only if they're protected from the fear of liability that the DMCA safe harbor gives them. So Viacom is saying here, YouTube shouldn't be able to claim the advantage of the DMCA safe harbor. YouTube is making money. YouTube is should be aware that lots of our content is there without authorization. I think they're trying to renege on the bargain that copyright holders and ISPs struck in the DMCA. Neither side got precisely what it wanted, but both of them got a deal that allowed this kind of innovative web hosting and service provider, and more importantly, enabled all of the sort of user-created content or peer production of material. So it gives us space to share with one another. And so I think that the DMCA should be reformed to address some of the burdens on speech, but not thrown out and not sort of undercut by claims like Viacom's that when there's so much material, suddenly DMCA stops applying. So I think I'll wrap it up there. And happily take questions now.
Awesome. Well, I have two questions. One, I'm not clear why you think the NFL is materially misrepresenting. Is it because they know that your clip doesn't violate copyright law, or is it because they asked YouTube again after the first takedown, take it down a second time?
It's because they know that this is non-infringing.
Isn't that sort of isn't there an argument there that they could make?
Yes, and they, since good faith mistake is not a knowing misrepresentation, that's the argument that they will likely make. I think that The reason I think the second notification is significant after I've already counter-notified is the first time it would be easy for them to claim this was just an oversight. We saw the word Super Bowl highlights, and this clip comes up showing some football players. We, in good faith, believed that it was an infringing segment of the game. By the time I'd notified and told them, here's what the content is and here's why it's non-infringing, they at least know that. Clearly the posture they're taking in these letters they're sending me is that they still have a good faith belief that that's non-infringing, that is infringing, and that this is just a difference of opinion. In the Diebold case, the court in the Northern District of California said no copyright holder could have believed that this was a reasonable claim of copyright as opposed to a fair use. I think this gets close to that standard, but we'd still have to litigate it to figure it out.
And my other question was, what is stopping me from taking, if it's just the broadcast that's copyrighted, what's stopping me from taking a camera into a stadium and filming the game myself and putting up my own highlights on YouTube? Is that illegal?
Nothing except the gate guards frisking you at the gate and claiming that your ticket is a contract that doesn't permit you to do that.
But is that legally...
The stadiums are their property, and so they can bar you from entering their stadiums on whatever terms they want. They couldn't prevent you from sitting on a rooftop that overlooked the stadium, the field, and trying to capture the game that way. There's a funny case where... I think it's over Wrigley Field. There are rooftops from which you can see the games, and they've tried to stop people from taking admission, paying guests up to the rooftops. Mostly
the
by
ticket as a contract, though. Also, ball clubs enforce that in terms of kicking people out of games when they interfere with balls in the field of play. And there's a whole. If you look, if you have a Red Sox ticket or other ticket at some point, read the back. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. I don't know that it's been litigated, but certainly they enforce it as if it is binding.
They enforce it at the game.
They enforce it at the game. So,
so if I got a tape out and put it online...
It
wouldn't be copyrighted.
No, that's right. It wouldn't be a copyright claim. The strongest claim that they'd have against you is breach of contract, and depending on the terms, precise terms of this contract, they might or might not
have
a claim.
Let's say you videotape it from one of those roofs.
If you videotape it from the roof, I think you're totally in the clear.
And then you can post it on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of clips on YouTube of camera phone clips of, you know, people, like there's a famous one of David Ortiz's big hit in the 2004 playoffs, you know, game four, I think. And there's a whole bunch of ones, you know, the kickoff return from the NFL game, actually, I watched on somebody's camera phone. It's an awful way to watch things, actually. They're on there and they don't seem to be... They get taken down.
Or in the equivalent case, if it's a Rolling Stones concert at Fenway and you tape it from your house, can you sell those things?
If it's music, then you've got separate copyrights that pre-exist in the music.
So if it's the game.
If it's the game and you take it from the rooftop, there's no copyright in the game itself, and so there's nothing preventing you, if you lawfully acquire that, from selling it as you wish.
What's the strongest trademark claim that someone could bring in this context?
They claim trademarks, of course, in their team names and in their uniforms and on all the accoutrements and in the word Super Bowl. If you wonder why all the circulars before the game that advertised the chips and salsa you could get told you to stock up for the big game rather than for the Super Bowl, it's because they enforce their trademarks against people. But trademark law doesn't prevent you from accurately describing something in which the trademark appears. So if you've got footage from the Super Bowl, you can't call it official Super Bowl footage or the official NFL shot of the game, but you could accurately describe it as the Colts on the field during the Super Bowl. I saw a question back there.
Yeah, it's a question about 512. It seems like that division clearly has bite where a group were to try to take down something that absolutely was not copyrighted. But then when it's a question of fair use, then fair use is a four-factor test. It's for a court to decide. And I mean, I guess getting to your case specifically, it seems like they could say there's something there to be litigated and we aren't knowingly misrepresenting anything. So I think it goes back to Catherine's question, but I guess, is that part of the weakness of Cloud Schwab? Is that fair use is...
Yes, and... I hear that the language knowingly materially misrepresents was put in by entertainment industry lobbyists in the negotiation of this statute. Absolutely, it's there to make it harder to make a claim against somebody who sends a takedown notice. Talking about the far end of wacky takedowns, BNA this morning reported the story of an Australian kid who sent YouTube hundreds of takedown notices for a television station's broadcasts, and the television station apparently was very happy to have its materials online and forced him to apologize. He could be held liable for knowingly materially misrepresenting, as well as criminally prosecuted for making false statements under penalty of perjury. Because he did not have the authority of the copyright holder to make those claims. But against cases of gray, this provision is less useful. I could bring a declaratory judgment over my rights to continue posting this material, but there's no... and there, also look to the costs and attorney's fees provisions of the copyright statute.
It's actually sort of funny in that case because the ABC's Chasers show that was being knocked off YouTube is their equivalent of the Daily Show. And they wanted
their version of the Daily Show?
Yeah, and they wanted to keep it up and the kid was hanging it down, which is sort of funny because of, but I thought the 512F part you were saying was that after you filed the counter notification, there's no way they could have a good faith belief that you're still infringing since you've already told them you're not and they have to trust you unless they want to litigate it. I thought that was sort of the point you'd made.
No, they're still entitled to their own interpretation of the law. It was more that once I had sent the counter notification, they knew very clearly what this was, and I thought and still think that it's a clear case of a fair use, and once they saw what it was, they could hardly hold a good faith belief that it was infringing, but
can you just
that's
be
what
the,
they're saying.
Professor on the other side and make their strongest response to your fair use claims? Because you gave a pretty good version of the four-factor test, but...
So the strongest claim from their side over this 20 seconds of football, which is now all that they're asserting the copyright protects. They say I haven't transformed it, and that I've merely taken it as it was in the broadcast and posted it without adding educational content into the clip specifically.
Did you do that to
even
make
though
your
I've surrounded
harder,
it?
Knowing full well that you could have done, made your case potentially.
I did it because I'm not a very good video editor. I pulled this off my Myth TV, which is a great little build-your-own digital video recorder. And I had they used the reverse of the commercial editing tool to snip out the little segment around the copyright warning, and 30 seconds was about as close as I could get to just the warning. As well as thinking that it's useful to have the football in there to show what's happening. But they'll argue that there wasn't much use to putting it there, that it's a creative work, the announcers describing the plays. And they argue, argue, or they tend to argue, that there are markets for licensing virtually everything. And if they want ESPN to keep paying them and phone companies to keep paying them to stream clips to camera phones, that this is a market on which I'm intruding.
It seems that for educational uses, they can survive this up again and down again regime, whereas a commercial use could never survive this kind of thing. I don't know if there are examples of people using things of dubious copyright in commercial uses, but do you think this was part of the negotiation of the DMCA that would kill commercial uses effectively? Well, allowing educational uses to kind of go up and down and be seen when, maybe not on the day of class when you need it, but weeks later.
The time period of down, I think, is in there to give the copyright holder a chance to file a lawsuit if it's really important to them that this material not be available online any longer. They can file a lawsuit within that window and keep it down. It does operate sort of in reverse of the ordinary presumptions about speech, which is that speech is lawful until absolutely proven unlawful, and elsewhere we have a very strong presumption against prior restraint. Here, because it's not the government but an internet service provider doing the restraining, we seem to allow that to happen more easily. I'm not sure anybody was really thinking a whole lot about the posters of content when this was happening. It was the ISPs and the complaining copyright holders who were in the room together hammering this out, and ISPs said, we want to be able to have a business, and that business involves users who will post all sorts of stuff, who knows what, and this seemed to be the right regime to do that. So in the chilling effects arena, we have seen commercial entities caught up by this as well. You have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering what you would argue your damages to be under 512F if you went forward with that claim.
Another tough question, because it's hard to quantify damages from speech. I haven't laid out any expenses in reliance on this clip being up. I didn't lose any money from students not paying to attend class because they couldn't hear me talk about the clip. So maybe if I had gone and found alternate hosting for it and I had had to pay $100 to some place that would host the video, I might be able to allege that. I might be able to allege some lost value from not having had it to show in my class on the day I wanted to discuss it.
What did you allege in DiBold?
It was the hosting costs and harm from having to cancel a conference, that a symposium that had been scheduled to discuss these memos. But the bulk of the And that, I think we alleged $5,000 in damages, and the bulk of it was attorney's fees, even though EFF did all of the work, and the Stanford Cyber Law Clinic did the work pro bono. Pro bono attorneys are entitled to get fees at the usual rate. I don't think I'd be able to get fees for representing myself, though. Jim?
Just, I guess, two quick questions, comments. One is, triggered by David, is the question about the filming of the yourself, is that I was recently reading about how in the Wall Street Journal, and that teams are starting to look at their players as entertainment and pay accordingly more by what they can bring in terms of entertainment value rather than sports value. So I'm curious if that's going to have any effect on the copyright situation there. You know, there's a difference between ballet and football, but maybe not anymore, or increasingly less so. The second, I'm hoping that videotaping this isn't going to harm your strategic, bringing up the case. I don't know if that's something that's of concern, but in terms of as you're revealing the other side's argument.
I think I'm not revealing anything they haven't already thought about.
Right. I guess I have a question about whether you've discovered, in a sense, you suggested that there's a strong you know, implication, but it isn't necessarily concluded that, that there is this process you're supposed to follow. But it seems like, is it true that they could just kind of keep going through the dance of the takedown and then put back and takedown and put back because it's not absolutely clear in the statute that you have to go to this next stage?
Unless I were to add a claim for something like tortious misuse of process, or abuse of process, or some of these weird torts that you can dig up about abuse of the legal system and vexatious litigation. But I mean, in a, more seriously, California has an anti-SLAPP statute prohibiting strategic lawsuits against public participation, where they recognize that legal process can be used to squelch legitimate speech. And so if this process continued, I might have a claim at least analogous to that, that they were now abusing process. But it's hard to say that the ordinary speaker would be better served by having a lawsuit filed against him.
Somebody, when John Edwards and Elizabeth Edwards went on 60 Minutes, somebody did a YouTube that aggregated only the questions from Katie Kirk. And in particular, it's like a minute and 20 seconds of her asking, "You don't really love your wife, do you?" Just sort of over and over. And you put them together, and it was a really pretty effective piece of political. They posted it, I linked to it, and noticed a few weeks later it's down. So I'm not a lawyer. This is newbie lawyer question. If John Stewart had done that clip and run it, sort of thing that he does,
sure. You know, just,
would is he protected differently than whoever it is who posted it at YouTube? It does sound like a fair use to you, by the way.
It does sound like a fair use, and indeed, I think sort of one of the ironies of the Viacom lawsuit is that John Stewart is one of the most effective fair users on TV. All of his sort of mashups of events from the day or evening news, juxtaposing clips of people speaking to make a point about them, are very much what other people go online to do. And I don't think it's more or less a fair use if you put it on the evening news than if you put it on YouTube.
So it's the same laws apply whether it's being broadcast or posted on the net.
Yeah, so he would argue that he is sort of engaged in commentary and even news reporting, even though it's fake news. But I think that the YouTube poster can make those same arguments. The law doesn't distinguish between the professional journalist and the amateur journalist, or if they are using similarly.
But there's no broadcast equivalent of DMCA. I mean, it doesn't even really make sense for broadcast for the most part because the files don't typically live anywhere. They're broadcast.
Right. No, that's right. And the equivalent is putting pressure on the broadcasters, of whom there are fewer, they are similarly risk-averse to the threat of multi-million dollar litigation and will tell anyone who is trying to get content broadcast through them, you'd better come to us with signed clearances for everything. I don't actually know, as a matter of fact, how Stewart does all of his clips, whether any of that is licensed or whether he asserts that it's all fair use. I hope he's asserting fair use.
Do you see a tension at all between, so in 512F, that kind of knowingly misrepresents standard, the issue that I see with it with fair use, although in the Diebold case is somewhat instructive, but that in that case it was so egregious, but you know, you're talking about fair use as a kind of legal determination based on a balancing test. And it's inherently kind of ambiguous as to whether something is fair use. You can make arguments on either side. Seems to me very difficult to pin somebody down on 512F, saying they knowingly materially misrepresented or that something was not fair use just because of that balancing test.
I would love for this statute to be stronger. Absolutely, and that's one of the areas in which I would suggest reform. Balance out the representations that the notifier and the counter-notifier have to make, and drop this knowing material and misrepresentation language, and just say any person whose material was incorrectly taken down, even if it takes a long time for a judge to reach the determination that it's a fair use, the other side should have the person who notified against it should have to bear the costs of that determination.
That said, I think in Diebold, having looked at that information for clinical project, looks like the judge there gave you about the best definition of knowingly that you could get and that you could hope to get. So, you know, considering that that's the main case out there in the field, certainly the precedential value of that is helpful.
I think so.
Do you see the Viacom case as one that will be successful for the media industry? And do you expect more to come, like the media industry trying to protect its own business model more than being interested in any legal stuff?
So do I think that one question to start is whether this will be litigated out or whether it will settle. And lots of people have speculated that YouTube is, that Viacom rather, filed the lawsuit as sort of a bargaining chip to raise the licensing fees it could demand from YouTube. But Google has a pretty good history of being willing to litigate cases rather than just settling. So I think they're still fighting on their Google Print project, and they fight against Perfect 10 when it comes forward claiming that their image gallery image search infringes. So I think that they will fight this one out.
The other half of Wendy and Alex.
Yes, that's right. My fellow first students at the Berkman Center is now counsel at a senior copyright counsel at Google, and a great guy. And
will other media do the same?
Well, we haven't seen them piling on yet. They may be waiting to see what happens in this one, because it's expensive to be on either side of a copyright litigation. And if that Viacom's willing to do it for them, they'll probably all file amicus briefs if it gets up to that point, and argue vociferously why it's important to protecting the biggest export the United States has, the entertainment industry and its copyright property, that the court rule in their favor. But I think that based on the statute of the DMCA, the legislative history around what Congress was being asked to do and was trying to do at the time, that YouTube's activities, while it's not static web pages, which is most of what Congress was looking at in 1998, is still very much the kind of activity that Congress was trying to protect. And that as long as a provider is following these guidelines, it should be absolved from liability, and it's up to the users and Viacom to fight out whether they should be posting this material. I think if the courts are doing sort of close reading of the statute, I think Google should come out on top here.
Would you be willing to provide a quick assessment of some of the infringement case in counts of infringement within the actual complaint and some of the merit there? Because my understanding is if Viacom wins on any of those, you know, contributory, vicarious, inducement, et cetera, then DMCA is a moot point because, or the safe harbors become a moot point because Google no longer qualifies for those. Is that a correct reading? And if so, what's your take on some of those particular
Sub-complaints. So the DMCA, I mean, just to go back to the language again, the DMCA, we're talking about subsection C, information residing on systems or networks at the direction of users, where it says that a service provider shall not be liable for monetary relief for infringement of copyright by reason of the storage at the direction of a user of material that resides on a system or network controlled or operated by or for the service provider. So that seems to be saying the safe harbor applies against claims of direct infringement for hosting user-provided material or claims of secondary liability for the hosting of user-provided material, provided that these exceptions don't apply, and provided that the provider is has a proper copyright policy and accepts notifications and responds to them. So Viacom is trying to say that its claims sort of go through or pierce the safe harbor protection, and I think properly read, the safe harbor is broader than Viacom makes it out to be, and protects even against the activities that Viacom is alleging as infringements. So even if there is in fact infringing content there, even if nobody will dispute that posting an entire daily show is infringement, YouTube shouldn't be liable as an infringer so long as it responds expeditiously each time somebody says that's where the Daily Show was posted.
So on something like the financial benefit claim, for example, it strikes you that Google, YouTube has a pretty good defense because there's not any way to demonstrate extremely direct financial benefit through, like, if you watch a particular infringing video, Google doesn't immediately get a buff or something. So there's a
right. So you're right. You're pointing to the section in here where it says that the safe harbor doesn't apply if the ISP receives a financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing activity. And the legislative history says that this is supposed to track vicarious liability pre-DMCA, which also has this sort of financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing activity is different from financial benefit that you get for providing the service, some of which content happens to be infringing. And I think the latter is where YouTube is. It doesn't take advertisements on pages with user-supplied video, so it's not making money from advertisers directly attributable to any infringements that those users might post. It makes money because people come to the site, and Viacom hasn't proved that its copyrighted material being infringed is the draw that brings people into YouTube and makes it a beneficial site. How are we doing on time?
Maybe one more question and then...
Okay.
Great. So now there seem to be statistics that say that YouTube knows that some percentage of its content is infringing. So I guess what's their argument that they're not aware of facts or circumstances from which infringing activity is occurring?
Okay, so can even just run through the three exceptions there. If you have actual knowledge, either because you've gotten the notification or because somebody has told you or you've viewed the video and seen that it infringes and know that it infringes, not just know that it's there, but know that it infringes, the safe harbor doesn't apply. The second, the C1A2 is referred to often as red flag knowledge. Even though you don't have that absolute direct knowledge, you should know to a near certainty that this material is infringing. And I think it still has to be more than general knowledge. So while it may well be general knowledge that people post infringing materials to YouTube, That's not enough to help them pinpoint which the infringing materials are, and when it's brought to their attention specifically, when somebody gives them actual knowledge, they remove it. But the difference between general knowledge that some people object to some of the stuff up there, or even lots of people object to lots of the stuff up there, and specific red flags are, that movie says pirated content here, get it while it's hot, is enough, I think, that that YouTube should keep the safe harbor while the proprietor of pirated content here, get it while it's hot, would have red flag knowledge that what somebody posted to that site was infringing. And upon obtaining such knowledge is the removal when somebody gives you the notification. You're not held liable if you act quickly once you get the notice.
Wendy, as always, a tour de force. It's clear that in this quicksilver technological environment, you will always be on the cutting edge. So that's great. It's great to have you with us. And Wendy will be here at Fellows Hour as well, to which everybody's invited back. Fellows Hour, a misnomer for the 90 minutes that fall between, I think, 3 and 4:30, but I'm sure more on this. Anyway, thank you, Wendy.
Okay, thank you all.